because a lot of them might be gone. Just gone. Fallen into the earth, vaporized, you name it. Strong enough to splinter these beams and twist them out of shape and knock stuff off the shelves, and the town whistle stopped at the same time. I was trying to visualize half the parking lot gone, trying to visualize walking out there and just coming to a brand new drop in the land where the hot top with its neat yellow-lined parking slots left off. A drop. A slope. Or maybe an out-and-out precipice falling away into the featureless white mist. After a couple of seconds, I said, "If you're right, how far do you think you're going to get in your pickup?" I wasn't thinking of my truck. I was thinking of your four-wheel drive. That was something to chew over, but not now. "What else is on your mind?" Miller was eager to go on. "The pharmacy next door, that's on my mind. What about that?" I opened my mouth to say I didn't have the slightest idea what he was talking about and then shut it with a snap. The Bridgeton pharmacy had been doing business when we drove in yesterday. Not the laundromat, but the drugstore had been wide open. The doors chocked with rubber doorstops to let in a little cool air. The power outage had killed their air conditioning, of course. The door to the pharmacy could be no more than 20 feet from the door of the Federal Market. So why? "Why haven't any of those people turned up over here?" Miller asked for me. "It's been 18 hours. Aren't they hungry? They're sure not over there eating Dristan and stay-free mini-pads." "There's food," I said. "They're always selling food items on special. Sometimes it's animal crackers, sometimes it's those toaster pastries, all sorts of things, plus the candy rack. I just don't believe they'd stick with stuff like that when there's all kinds of stuff over here." "What are you getting at?" "What I'm getting at is that I want to get out, but I don't want to be dinner for some refugee from a grade B horror picture. 4 or 5 of us could go next door and check out the situation in the drugstore as a sort of trial balloon."
"That's everything?"
"No, there's one other thing."
"What's that?"
"Her," Miller said simply, and jerked his thumb toward one of the middle aisles. "That crazy cunt. That witch." It was Mrs. Carmody he had jerked his thumb at. She was no longer alone. 2 women had joined her. From their bright clothes, I guessed they were probably tourists or summer people, ladies who had maybe left their families to just run into town and get a few things, and were now eaten up with worry over their husbands and kids, ladies eager to grasp at almost any straw, maybe even the black comfort of a Mrs. Carmody. Her pantsuit shone out with its same baleful resplendence. She was talking, gesturing, her face hard and grim. The 2 ladies in their bright clothes, but not as bright as Mrs. Carmody's pantsuit, no, and her gigantic satchel of a purse was still tucked firmly under one doughy arm, were listening, raptly. "She's another reason I want to get out, Drayton. By tonight she'll have 6 people sitting with her. If those pink bugs and the birds come back tonight, she'll have a whole congregation sitting with her by tomorrow morning. And then we can start worrying about who she'll tell them to sacrifice to make it all better. Maybe me, or you, or that guy Hatlin. Maybe your kid." "That's idiocy," I said. But was it? The cold chill crawling up my back said not necessarily. Mrs. Carmody's mouth moved and moved. The eyes of the tourist ladies were fixed on her wrinkled lips. Was it idiocy? I thought of the dusty stuffed animals drinking at their looking glass stream. Mrs. Carmody had power. Even Steph, normally hard-headed and straight from the shoulder, invoked the old lady's name with unease. "That crazy cunt," Miller had called her. "That witch." "The people in this market are going through a Section 8 experience for sure," Miller said. He gestured at the red painted beams framing the show window segments, twisted and splintered and buckled out of shape. "Their minds probably feel like those beams look. Mine sure as shit does. I spent half of last night thinking I must have flipped out of my gourd, that I was probably in a straitjacket in Danvers, raving my head off about bugs and dinosaur birds and tentacles, and that it would all go away just as soon as the nice orderly came along and shot a wad of Thorazine into my arm." His small face was strained and white. He looked at Mrs. Carmody and then back at me. "I tell you, it might happen. As people get flakier, she's going to look better and better to some of them, and I don't want to be around if that happens." Mrs. Carmody's lips moving and moving, her tongue
dancing around her old lady's snaggle teeth. She did look like a witch. Put her in a pointy black hat and she would be perfect. What was she saying to her two captured birds in their bright summer plumage? Arrowhead Project? Black Spring? Abominations from the cellars of the earth? Human sacrifice? Bullshit. All the same.
So what do you say?
I'll go this far, I answered him. We'll try going over to the drug. You, me, Ollie, if he wants to go, one or two others. Then we'll talk it over again. Even that gave me the feeling of walking out over an impossible drop on a narrow beam. I wasn't going to help Billy by killing myself. On the other hand, I wasn't going to help him by just sitting on my ass either. 20 feet to the drugstore. That wasn't so bad.
When?
He asked. Give me an hour.
Sure, he said.
9. The expedition to the pharmacy. I told Mrs. Terman, and I told Amanda, and then I told Billy. He seemed better this morning. He had eaten 2 donuts and a bowl of Special K for breakfast. Afterward, I raced him up and down 2 of the aisles and even got him giggling a little. Kids are so adaptable that they can scare the living shit right out of you. He was too pale. The flesh under his eyes was still puffed from the tears he had cried in the night, and his face had a horribly used look. In a way, it had become like an old man's face, as if too much emotional voltage had been running behind it for too long. But he was still alive, and still able to laugh, at least until he remembered where he was and what was happening. After the wind sprints, we sat down with Amanda and Hattie Terman and drank Gatorade from paper cups, and I told him I was going over to the drugstore with a few other people.
I don't want you to, he said immediately, his face clouding. It'll be all right, Big Bill. I'll bring you a Spider-Man comic book. I want you to stay here.
Now his face was not just cloudy, it was thundery. I took his hand. He pulled it away. I took it again.
Billy, we have to get out of here sooner or later. You see that, don't you? When the fog goes away... But he spoke with no conviction at all. He drank his Gatorade slowly and without relish.
Billy, it's been almost one whole day now.
I want Mommy.
Well, maybe this is the first step on the way to getting back to her.
Mrs. Terman said, don't build the boy's hopes up, David.
What the hell? I snapped at her. The kid's got to hope for something.
She dropped her eyes. Yes, I suppose he does.
Billy took no notice of this.
Daddy, Daddy, there are things out there. Things.
Yes, we know that. But a lot of them, not all, but a lot, don't seem to come out until it's nighttime.
They'll wait, he said.
His eyes were huge, centered on mine.
They'll wait in the fog, and when you can't get back inside, they'll come to eat you up, like in the fairy stories.
He hugged me with fierce, panicky tightness.
Daddy, please don't go.
I pried his arms loose as gently as I could and told him that I had to. But I'll be back, Billy.
All right,
he said huskily, but he wouldn't look at me anymore. He didn't believe I would be back. It was on his face, which was no longer thundery, but woeful and grieving. I wondered again if I could be doing the right thing, putting myself at risk. Then I happened to glance down the middle aisle and saw Mrs. Carmody there. She had gained a third listener, a man with a grizzled cheek and a mean and rolling bloodshot eye. His haggard brow and shaking hands almost screamed the word hangover. It was none other than your friend and his, Myron LaFleur. The fellow who had felt no compunction at all about sending a boy out to do a man's job. That crazy cunt. That witch. I kissed Billy and hugged him hard. Then I walked down to the front of the store, but not down the housewares aisle. I didn't want to fall under her eye. 3/4 of the way down, Amanda caught up with me.
Do you really have to do this? She asked.
Yes, I think so.
Forgive me if I say it sounds like so much macho bullshit to me.
There were spots of color high on her cheeks, and her eyes were greener than ever. She was royally pissed. I took her arm and recapped my discussion with Dan Miller. The riddle of the cars and the fact that no one from the pharmacy had joined us didn't move her much. The business about Mrs. Carmody did.
He could be right, she said. Do you really believe that?
I don't know. There's a poisonous feel to that woman. And if people are frightened badly enough for long enough, they'll turn to anyone that promises a solution.
But human sacrifice, Amanda?
The Aztecs were into it, she said evenly. Listen, David, you come back. If anything happens, anything, you come back. Cut and run if you have to. Not for me. What happened last night was nice, but that was last night. Come back for your boy.
Yes, I will.
I wonder, she said, and now she looked like Billy, haggard and old. It occurred to me that most of us looked that way, but not Mrs. Carmody. Mrs. Carmody looked younger somehow, and more vital, as if she had come into her own, as if she were thriving on it.
We didn't get going until 9:30 a.m. Seven of us went. Ollie, Dan Miller, Mike Hatlin, Myron LaFleur's erstwhile buddy Jim, also hungover but seemingly determined to find some way to atone, Buddy Eagleton, myself. The seventh was Hilda Repler. Miller and Hatlin tried half-heartedly to talk her out of coming. She would have none of it. I didn't even try. I suspected she might be more competent than any of us, except maybe for Ollie. She was carrying a small canvas shopping basket, and it was loaded with an arsenal of Raid and Black Flag spray cans, all of them uncapped and ready for action. In her free hand she held a Spalding Jimmy Connors tennis racket from a display of sporting goods in aisle two.
"What's you gonna do with that, Mrs. Repler?"
Jim asked.
"I don't know," she said. She had a low, raspy, competent voice. "But it feels right in my hand."
She looked him over closely, and her eye was cold.
"Jim Grandin, isn't it? Didn't I have you in school?"
Jim's lips stretched in an uneasy, egg-sucked grin.
"Yes'm, me and my sister, Pauline."
"Too much to drink last night?"
Jim, who towered over her and probably outweighed her by 100 pounds, blushed to the roots of his American Legion crew cut.
No.
She turned away curtly, cutting him off.
"I think we're ready," she said.
All of us had something, although you would have called it an odd assortment of weapons. Holly had Amanda's gun. Buddy Eagleton had a steel pinch bar from out back somewhere. I had a broom handle.
"Okay," Dan Miller said, raising his voice a bit. "You folks want to listen up a minute?"
A dozen people had drifted down toward the outdoor to see what was going on. They were loosely knotted, and to their right stood Mrs. Carmody and her new friends.
"We're going over to the drugstore to see what the situation is there. Hopefully we'll be able to bring something back to aid Mrs. Clapham."
She was the lady who had been trampled yesterday when the bugs came. One of her legs had been broken, and she was in a great deal of pain. Miller looked us over.
"We're not going to take any chances," he said. "At the first sign of anything threatening, we're going to pop back into the market."
"And bring all the fiends of hell down on our heads," Mrs. Carmody cried.
"She's right,"
one of the summer ladies seconded.
"You'll make them notice us. You'll make them come. Why can't you just leave well enough alone?"
There was a murmur of agreement from some of the people who had gathered to watch us go. I said, "Lady, is this what you call well enough?" She dropped her eyes, confused. Mrs. Carmody marched a step forward. Her eyes were blazing.
"You'll die out there, David Drayton. Do you want to make your son an orphan?"
She raised her eyes and raked all of us with them. Buddy Eagleton dropped his eyes and simultaneously raised the pinch bar as if to ward her off.
"All of you will die out there. Haven't you realized that the end of the world has come? The fiend has been let loose. Star Wormwood blazes. And each one of you that steps out that door will be torn apart. And they'll come for those of us who are left, just as this good woman said. Are you people going to let that happen?
She was appealing to the onlookers now, and a little mutter ran through them.
After what happened to the unbelievers yesterday? It's death! It's death! It's...
A can of peas flew across two of the checkout lanes suddenly and struck Mrs. Carmody on the right breast. She staggered backward with a startled squawk. Amanda stood forward. Shut up, she said. Shut up, you miserable buzzard.
She serves the foul one,
Mrs. Carmody screamed. A jittery smile hung on her face.
Who did you sleep with last night, missus? Who did you lie down with last night? Mother Carmody sees. Oh, yes, Mother Carmody sees what others miss.
But the moment spell she had created was broken, and Amanda's eyes never wavered. Are we going, or are we going to stand here all day? Mrs. Repler asked. And we went. God help us, we went. Dan Miller was in the lead. Ollie came second. I was last, with Mrs. Repler in front of me. I was as scared as I've ever been, I think, and the hand wrapped around my broom handle was sweaty slick. There was a thin, acrid, and unnatural smell of the mist. By the time I got out the door, Miller and Ollie had already faded into it, and Hatlin, who was third, was nearly out of sight. Only 20 feet, I kept telling myself. Only 20 feet. Mrs. Repler walked slowly and firmly ahead of me, her tennis racket swinging lightly from her right hand. To our left was a red cinder block wall. To our right, the first rank of cars looming out of the mist like ghost ships. Another trash barrel materialized out of the whiteness, and beyond that was a bench where people sometimes sat to wait their turn at the payphone. Only 20 feet. Miller's probably there by now. 20 feet is only 10 or 12 paces, so...
Oh, my God! Miller screamed. Oh, dear sweet God, look at this!
Miller had gotten there, all right. Buddy Eagleton was ahead of Mrs. Repler, and he turned to run, his eyes wide and starry. She batted him lightly in the chest with her tennis racket.
Where do you think you're going?
She asked in her tough, slightly raspy voice, and that was all the panic there was. The rest of us drew up to Miller. I took one glance back over my shoulder and saw that the Federal had been swallowed by the mist. The red cinderblock wall faded to a thin wash pink and then disappeared utterly, probably 5 feet on the Bridgeton Pharmacy side of the outdoor. I felt more isolated, more simply alone than ever in my life. It was as if I had lost the womb. The pharmacy had been the scene of a slaughter. Miller and I, of course, were very close to it, almost on top of it. All the things in the mist operated primarily by sense of smell. It stood to reason. Sight would have been almost completely useless to them. Hearing, a little better, but as I've said, the mist had a way of screwing up the acoustics, making things that were close sound distant, and sometimes things that were far away sound close. The things in the mist followed their truest sense. They followed their noses. Those of us in the market had been saved by the power outage as much as by anything else. The electric eye doors wouldn't operate. In a sense, the market had been sealed up when the mist came, but the pharmacy doors, they had been chocked open. The power failure had killed their air conditioning, and they had opened the doors to let in the breeze. Only something else had come in as well. A man in a maroon T-shirt lay face down in the doorway. Or at first I thought his T-shirt was maroon. Then I saw a few white patches at the bottom and understood that once it had been all white. The maroon was dried blood, and there was something else wrong with him. I puzzled it over in my mind. Even when Buddy Eagleton turned around and was noisily sick, it didn't come immediately. I guess when something that final happens to someone, your mind rejects it at first. Unless maybe you're in a war. His head was gone. That's what it was. His legs were splayed out inside the pharmacy doors, and his head should have been hanging over the low step, but his head just wasn't. Jim Grondin had had enough. He turned away, his hands over his mouth, his bloodshot eyes gazing madly into mine. Then he stumbled, staggered back toward the market. The others took no notice. Miller had stepped inside. Mike Hatlin followed. Mrs. Repler stationed herself at one side of the double doors with her tennis racket. Ollie stood on the other side with Amanda's gun drawn and pointing at the pavement. He said quietly, "I seem to be running out of hope, David." Buddy Eagleton was leaning weakly against the payphone stall like someone who has just gotten bad news from home. His broad shoulders shook with the force of his sobs. "Don't count us out yet," I said to Ollie. I stepped up to the door. I didn't want to go inside, but I had promised my son a comic book. The Bridgeton Pharmacy was a crazy shambles. Paperbacks and magazines were everywhere. There was a Spider-Man comic and an Incredible Hulk almost at my feet, and without thinking, I picked them up and jammed them into my back pocket for Billy. Bottles and boxes lay in the aisles. A hand hung over one of the racks. Unreality washed over me. The wreckage, the carnage, that was bad enough. But the place also looked like it had been the scene of some crazy party. It was hung and festooned with what I at first took to be streamers. But they weren't broad and flat, they were more like very thick strings or very thin cables. It struck me that they were almost the same bright white as the mist itself, and a cold chill sketched its way up my back like frost. Not crepe. What? Magazines and books hung dangling in the air from some of them. Mike Hatlin was prodding a strange black thing with one foot. It was long and bristly. "What the fuck is this?" he asked no one in particular. And suddenly, I knew. I knew what had killed all those unlucky enough to be in the pharmacy when the mist came. The people who had been unlucky enough to get smelled out. Out. "Out," I said. My throat was completely dry and the word came out like a lint-covered bullet. "Get out of here!" Ollie looked at me.
"David?"
"They're spider webs," I said, and then two screams came out of the mist. The first of fear, maybe, the second of pain. It was Jim. If there were dues to be paid, he was paying them. "Get out!" I shouted at Mike and Dan Miller. Then something looped out of the mist. It was impossible to see it against that white background, but I could hear it. It sounded like a bullwhip that had been half-heartedly flicked. And I could see it when it twisted around the thigh of Buddy Eagleton's jeans. He screamed and grabbed for the first thing handy, which happened to be the telephone. The handset flew the length of its cord and then swung back and forth.
"Oh, Jesus, that hurts!"
Buddy screamed. Ollie grabbed for him, and I saw what was happening. At the same instant, I understood why the head of the man in the doorway was missing. The thin white cable that had twisted around Buddy's leg like a silk rope was sinking into his flesh. That leg of his jeans had been neatly cut off and was sliding down his leg. A neat circular incision in his flesh was brimming blood as the cable went deeper. Ollie pulled him hard. There was a thin snapping sound and Buddy was free. His lips had gone blue with shock. Mike and Dan were coming, but too slowly. Then Dan ran into several hanging threads and got stuck exactly like a bug on flypaper. He freed himself with a tremendous jerk, leaving a flap of his shirt hanging from the webbing. Suddenly, the air was full of those languorous bullwhip cracks, and the thin white cables were drifting down all around us. They were coated with the same corrosive substance. I dodged two of them more by luck than by skill. One landed at my feet and I could hear a faint hiss of bubbling hot top. Another floated out of the air and Mrs. Repler calmly swung her tennis racket at it. The thread stuck fast and I heard a high-pitched twing, twing, twing as the corrosive ate through the racket's strings and snapped them. It sounded like someone rapidly plucking the strings of a violin. A moment later, a thread wrapped around the upper handle of the racket and it was jerked into the mist. "Get back!" Ollie screamed. We got moving. Ollie had an arm around Buddy. Dan Miller and Mike Hatlin were on each side of Mrs. Repler. The white strands of web continued to drift out of the fog. impossible to see unless your eye could pick them out against the red cinder block background. One of them wrapped around Mike Hatlin's left arm. Another whipped around his neck in a series of quick winding-up snaps. His jugular went in a jetting, jumping explosion, and he was dragged away, head lolling. One of his bass loafers fell off and lay there on its side. Buddy suddenly slumped forward, almost dragging Ollie to his knees.
"He's passed out, David. Help me."
I grabbed Buddy around the waist and we pulled him along in a clumsy, stumbling fashion. Even in unconsciousness, Buddy kept his grip on his steel pinch bar. The leg that the strand of web had wrapped around hung away from his body at a terrible angle. Mrs. Repler had turned around.
"Where?" she screamed in her rusty voice. "Where behind you?"
As I started to turn, one of the web strands floated down on top of Dan Miller's head. His hands beat at it, tore at it. One of the spires had come out of the mist from behind us. It was the size of a big dog. It was black with yellow piping. "Racing stripes," I thought crazily. Its eyes were reddish-purple, like pomegranates. It strutted busily toward us on what might have been as many as 12 or 14 many-jointed legs. It was no ordinary earthly spider blown up to horror movie size. It was something totally different. Perhaps not really a spider at all. Seeing it, Mike Hatlin would have understood what that bristly black thing he had been prodding at in the pharmacy really was. It closed in on us, spinning its webbing from an oval-shaped orifice on its upper belly. The strands floated out toward us in what was nearly a fan shape. Looking at this nightmare, so like the death-black spiders brooding over their dead flies and bugs in the shadows of our boathouse, I felt my mind trying to tear completely loose from its moorings. I believe now that it was only the thought of Billy that allowed me to keep any semblance of sanity. I was making some sound, laughing, crying, screaming, I don't know. But Ollie Weeks was like a rock. He raised Amanda's pistol as calmly as a man on a target range and emptied it in spaced shots into the creature at point-blank range. Whatever hell it came from, it wasn't invulnerable. A black ichor splattered from its body, and it made a terrible mewling sound, so low it was more felt than heard, like a bass note from a synthesizer. Then it scuttered back into the mist and was gone. It might have been a phantasm from a horrible drug dream, except for the puddles of sticky black stuff it had left behind. There was a clang as Buddy finally dropped his steel pinch bar.
"He's dead," Ollie said. "Let him go, David. The fucking thing got his femoral artery. He's dead. Let's get the Christ out of here."
His face was once more running with sweat and his eyes bulged from his big round face. One of the web strands floated easily down on the back of his hand and Ollie swung his arm, snapping it. The strand left a bloody wheel. Mrs. Repler screamed, "Where?" again, and we turned toward her. Another of them had come out of the mist and had wrapped its legs around Dan Miller in a mad lover's embrace. He was striking at it with his fists. As I bent and picked up Buddy's pinch bar, the spider began to wrap Dan in its deadly thread, and his struggles became a grisly, jittering death dance. Mrs. Repler walked toward the spider with a can of Black Flag insect repellent held outstretched in one hand. The spider's legs reached for her. She depressed the button and a cloud of the stuff jetted into one of its sparkling jewel-like eyes. That low-pitched mewling sound came again. The spider seemed to shudder all over and then it began to lurch backward, hairy legs scratching at the pavement. It dragged Dan's body, bumping and rolling behind it. Mrs. Repler threw the can of bug spray at it. It bounced off the spider's body and clattered to the hot top. The spider struck the side of a small sports car hard enough to make it rock on its springs, and then it was gone. I got to Mrs. Repler, who was swaying on her feet and dead pale. I put an arm around her. "Thank you, young man," she said. "I feel a bit faint." "That's okay," I said hoarsely. "I would have saved him if I could." "I know that." Ollie joined us. We ran for the market doors, the threads falling all around us. One lit on Mrs. Repler's marketing basket and sank into the canvas side. She tussled grimly for what was hers, dragging back on the strap with both hands, but she lost it. It went bumping off into the mist, end over end. As we reached the end door, a smaller spider, no bigger than a cocker spaniel puppy, raced out of the fog along the side of the building. It was producing no webbing. Perhaps it wasn't mature enough to do so. As Ollie leaned one beefy shoulder against the door so Mrs. Repler could go through, I heaved the steel bar at the thing like a javelin and impaled it. It writhed madly, legs scratching at the air, and its red eyes seemed to find mine and mark me.
David!
Ollie was still holding the door. I ran in. He followed me. Pallid, frightened faces stared at us. Seven of us had gone out, three of us had come back. Ollie leaned against the heavy glass door, barrel chest heaving. He began to reload Amanda's gun. His white assistant manager's shirt was plastered to his body, and large gray sweat stains had crept out from under his arms. "What?" someone asked in a low, hoarse voice. "Spiders," Mrs. Repler answered grimly. "The dirty bastard snatched my market basket." Then Billy hurled his way into my arms, crying. I held on to him, tight. 10. The Spell of Mrs. Carmody. The second night in the market. The final confrontation. It was my turn to sleep, and for 4 hours I remember nothing at all. Amanda told me I talked a lot and screamed once or twice, but I remember no dreams. When I woke up, it was afternoon. I was terribly thirsty. Some of the milk had gone over, but some of it was still okay. I drank a quart. Amanda came over to where Billy, Mrs. Terman, and I were. The old man who had offered to make a try for the shotgun in the trunk of his car was with her. Cornell, I remembered. Ambrose Cornell. "How are you, son?" he asked. "All right." But I was still thirsty and my head ached. Most of all, I was scared. I slipped an arm around Billy and looked from Cornell to Amanda. "What's up?" Amanda said, "Mr. Cornell is worried about that Mrs. Carmody. So am I." "Billy, why don't you take a walk over here with me?" Hattie asked. "I don't want to," Billy said. "Go on, Big Bill," I told him, and he went, reluctantly. "Now what about Mrs. Carmody?" I asked.
"She's stirring things up," Cornell said. He looked at me with an old man's grimness. "I think we got to put a stop to it, just about any way we can."
Amanda said, "There are almost a dozen people with her now. It's like some crazy kind of a church service." I remembered talking with a writer friend who lived in Otisfield and supported his wife and two kids by raising chickens and turning out one paperback original a year, spy stories. We had gotten talking about the bulge in popularity of books concerning themselves with the supernatural. Galt pointed out that in the 40s, Weird Tales had only been able to pay a pittance, and that in the 50s, it went broke. "When the machines fail," he had said, while his wife candled eggs and roosters crowed querulously outside, "when the technologies fail, when the conventional religious systems fail, people have got to have something. Even a zombie lurching through the night can seem pretty cheerful compared to the existential comedy horror of the ozone layer dissolving under the combined assault of a million fluorocarbon spray cans of deodorant." We had been trapped here for 26 hours, and we hadn't been able to do diddly shit. Our one expedition outside had resulted in 57% losses. It wasn't so surprising that Mrs. Carmody had turned into a growth stock, maybe. "Has she really got a dozen people?" I asked.
"Well, only 8, Cornell said. "But she never shuts up. It's like those 10-hour speeches Castro used to make. It's a goddamn filibuster."
8 people. Not that many. Not even enough to fill up a jury box. But I understood the worry on their faces. It was enough to make them the single largest political force in the market, especially now that Dan and Mike were gone. The thought that the biggest single group in our closed system was listening to her rant on about the pits of hell and the 7 vials being opened made me feel pretty damn claustrophobic.
She started talking about human sacrifice again, Amanda said. Bud Brown came over and told her to stop talking that drivel in his store. And 2 of the men that are with her, one of them was that man Myron LaFleur, told him he was the one who better shut up because it was still a free country. He wouldn't shut up, and there was a shoving match, I guess you'd say.
Brown got a bloody nose, Cornell said. They mean business.
I said, surely not to the point of actually killing someone. Cornell said softly, I don't know how far they'll go if that mess doesn't let up, but I don't want to find out. I intend to get out of here.
Easier said than done, but something had begun to tick over in my mind. Scent. That was the key. We had been left pretty much alone in the market. The bugs might have been attracted to the light as more ordinary bugs were. The birds had simply followed their food supply. But the bigger things had left us alone unless we unbuttoned for some reason. The slaughter in the Bridgeton pharmacy had occurred because the doors had been left chalked open. I was sure of that. The thing or things that had gotten Norton at his party had sounded as big as a house, but it or they hadn't come near the market, and that meant that maybe... Suddenly I wanted to talk to Ollie Weeks. I needed to talk to him.
I intend to get out or die trying, Cornell said. I got no plans to spend the rest of the summer in here.
There have been 4 suicides, Amanda said suddenly.
What? The first thing to cross my mind in a semi-guilty flash was that the bodies of the soldiers had been discovered.
Pills, Cornell said shortly. Me and 2 or 3 other guys carried the bodies out back.
I had to stifle a shrill laugh. We had a regular morgue going back there.
It's thinning out, Cornell said. I want to get gone.
You won't make it to your car, believe me.
Not even to that first rank? That's closer than the drugstore.
I didn't answer him. Not then. About an hour later, I found Ollie holding up the beer cooler and drinking a bush. His face was impassive, but he also seemed to be watching Mrs. Carmody. She was tireless, apparently, and she was indeed discussing human sacrifice again, only now no one was telling her to shut up. Some of the people who had told her to shut up yesterday were either with her today, or at least willing to listen, and the others were outnumbered.
She could have them talked around to it by tomorrow morning, Ollie remarked. Maybe not, but if she did, who do you think she'd single out for the honor?
Bud Brown had crossed her. So had Amanda. There was the man who had struck her, and then, of course, there was me. Ollie, I said, I think maybe 6 of us could get out of here. I don't know how far we'd get, but I think we could at least get out.
How?
I laid it out for him. It was simple enough. If we dashed across to my scout and piled in, they would get no human scent, at least not with the windows rolled up.
But suppose they're attracted to some other scent, Ollie asked. Exhaust, for instance.
Then we'd be cooked, I agreed.
Motion, he said. The motion of a car through fog might also draw them, David.
I don't think so. Not without the scent of prey. I really believe that's the key to getting away.
But you don't know.
No, not for sure.
Where would you want to go?
First, home, to get my wife.
David?
All right, to check, to be sure.
The things out there could be every place, David. They could get you the minute you stepped out of your scout into your dooryard.
If that happened, the scout would be yours. All I'd ask would be that you take care of Billy as well as you could for as long as you could.
Ollie finished his bush and dropped the can back into the cooler where it clattered among the empties. The butt of the gun Amanda's husband had given her protruded from his pocket.
South? He asked, meeting my eyes.
Yeah, I would, I said. Go south and try to get out of the mist. Try like hell.
How much gas you got?
Almost full.
Have you thought that it might be impossible to get out?
I had. Suppose what they had been fooling with at the Arrowhead Project had pulled this entire region into another dimension as easily as you or I would turn a sock inside out. It had crossed my mind, I said, but the alternative seems to be waiting around to see who Mrs. Carmody taps for the place of honor.
Were you thinking about today?
No, it's afternoon already, and those things get active at night. I was thinking about tomorrow, very early.
Who would you want to take?
Me, and you, and Billy. Hattie Terman. Amanda Dumfries. That old guy, Cornell, and Mrs. Repler. Maybe Bud Brown, too. That's eight, but Billy can sit on someone's lap and we can all squash together.
He thought it over. All right, he said finally.
We'll try.
Have you mentioned this to anyone else?
No, not yet.
My advice would be not to. Not until about 4 tomorrow morning. I'll put a couple of bags of groceries under the checkout nearest the door. If we're lucky, we can squeak out before anyone knows what's happening.
His eyes drifted to Mrs. Carmody again.
If she knew, she might try to stop us.
You think so? Ollie got another beer.
I think so, he said.
That afternoon, yesterday afternoon, passed in a kind of slow motion. Darkness crept in, turning the fog to that dull chrome color again. What world was left outside slowly dissolved to black by 8:30. The pink bugs returned, then the bird things swooping into the windows and scooping them up. Something roared occasionally from the dark, and once, shortly before midnight, there was a long, drawn-out, that caused people to turn toward the blackness with frightened, searching faces. It was the sort of sound you'd imagine a bull alligator might make in a swamp. It went pretty much as Miller had predicted. By the small hours, Mrs. Carmody had gained another half a dozen souls. Mr. McVeigh the butcher was among them, standing with his arms folded, watching her. She was totally wound up. She seemed to need no sleep. Her sermon, a steady stream of horrors out of Dore, Bosch, and Jonathan Edwards, went on and on, building toward some climax. Her group began to murmur with her, to rock back and forth unconsciously, like true believers at a tent revival. Their eyes were shiny and blank. They were under her spell. Around 3 a.m., the sermon went on relentlessly, and the people who were not interested had retreated to the back to try to get some sleep. I saw Ollie put a bag of groceries on a shelf under the checkout nearest the outdoor. Half an hour later, he put another bag beside it. No one appeared to notice him but me. Billy, Amanda, and Mrs. Terman slept together by the denuded cold cut section. I joined them and fell into an uneasy doze. At 4:15 by my wristwatch, Ollie shook me awake. Cornell was with him, his eyes gleaming brightly from behind his spectacles.
It's time, David, Ollie said.
A nervous cramp hit my belly and then passed. I shook Amanda awake.
The question of what might happen with both Amanda and Stephanie in the car together passed into my mind and then passed right out again.
Today it would be best to take things just as they came. Those remarkable green eyes opened and looked into mine.
David?
We're going to take a stab at getting out of here. Do you want to come?
What are you talking about?
I started to explain, then woke up Mrs. Terman so I would only have to go through it the once.
Your theory about scent, Amanda said. It's really only an educated guess at this point, isn't it?
Yes.
It doesn't matter to me, Hattie said. Her face was white, and in spite of the sleep she'd gotten, there were large, discolored patches under her eyes. I would do anything, take any chances, just to see the sun again.
Just to see the sun again. A little shiver coursed through me. She had put her finger on a spot that was very close to the center of my own fears, on the sense of almost foregone doom that had gripped me since I had seen Norm dragged out through the loading door. You could only see the sun through the mist as a little silver coin. It was like being on Venus. It wasn't so much the monstrous creatures that lurked in the mist. My shot with the pinch bar had shown me they were no Lovecraftian horrors with immortal life, but only organic creatures with their own vulnerabilities. It was the mist itself that sapped the strength and robbed the will. Just to see the sun again. She was right. That alone would be worth going through a lot of hell. I smiled at Hattie, and she smiled tentatively back. Yes, Amanda said. Me too. I began to shake Billy awake as gently as I could. I'm with you, Mrs. Repler said briefly. We were all together by the meat counter, all but Bud Brown. He had thanked us for the invitation and then declined it. He would not leave his place in the market, he said, but added in a remarkably gentle tone of voice that he didn't blame Ollie for doing so. An unpleasant Swedish aroma was beginning to drift up from the white enamel case now, a smell that reminded me of the time our freezer went on the fritz while we were spending a week on the Cape. Perhaps, I thought, it was the smell of spoiling meat that had driven Mr. McVeigh over to Mrs. Carmody's team.
Expiation! It's expiation we want to think about now. We have been scourged with whips and scorpions. We have been punished for delving into secrets forbidden by God of old. We have seen the lips of the earth open. We have seen the obscenities of nightmare. The rock will not hide them. The dead tree gives no shelter. And how will it end? What will stop it?
Expiation, shouted good old Myron LaFleur.
Expiation. Expiation.
They whispered it uncertainly.
Let me hear you say it like you mean it,
Mrs. Carmody shouted. The veins stood out on her neck in bulging cords. Her voice was cracking and hoarse now, but still full of power. And it occurred to me that it was the mist that had given her that power. The power to cloud men's minds, to make a particularly apt pun, just as it had taken away the sun's power from the rest of us. Before, she had been nothing but a mildly eccentric old woman with an antique store in a town that was lousy with antique stores. Nothing but an old woman with a few stuffed animals in the back room and a reputation for that witch, that cunt, folk medicine. It was said she could find water with an applewood stick, that she could charm warts and sell you a cream that would fade freckles to shadows of their former selves. I had even heard, was it from old Bill Giusti, that Mrs. Carmody could be seen, in total confidence, about your love life, that if you were having the bedroom miseries, she could give you a drink that would put the ram back in your rod.
Expiation!
They all cried together.
Expiation, that's right!
She shouted deliriously.
It's expiation! Gonna clear away this fog! Expiation! Gonna clear off these monsters and abominations! Expiation! Gonna drop the scales of mist from our eyes and let us see!
Her voice dropped a notch. And what does the Bible say expiation is?
What is the only cleanser for sin in the eye and mind of God?
Blood. This time the chill shuddered up through my entire body, cresting at the nape of my neck and making the hairs there stiffen. Mr. McVeigh had spoken that word. Mr. McVeigh, the butcher, who had been cutting meat in Bridgeton ever since I was a kid holding my father's talented hand. Mr. McVeigh, taking orders and cutting meat in his stained whites. Mr. McVeigh, whose acquaintanceship with the knife was long, yes, and with the saw and cleaver as well. Mr. McVeigh, who would understand better than anyone else that the cleanser of the soul flows from the wounds of the body. Blood, they whispered.
Daddy, I'm scared,
Billy said. He was clutching my hand tightly, his small face strained and pale. Ollie, I said, why don't we get out of this loony bin? Right on, he said. Let's go. We started down the second aisle in a loose group. Ollie, Amanda, Cornell, Mrs. Terman, Mrs. Repler, Billy,
and I. It was 4:45 in the morning, and the mist was beginning to lighten again.
"You and Cornell take the grocery bags," Ollie said to me.
"Okay."
"I'll go first. Your scout is a four-door, is it?"
"Yeah, it is."
"Okay. I'll open the driver's door and the back door on the same side. Mrs. Dumfries, can you carry Billy?"
She picked him up in her arms. "Am I too heavy?" Billy asked. "No, hun." "Good."
"You and Billy get in front," Ollie went on. "Shove way over. Mrs. Terman in front, in the middle. David, you behind the wheel. The rest of us will..."
"Where did you think you were going?"
It was Mrs. Carmody. She stood at the head of the checkout line where Ollie had hidden the bags of groceries. Her pantsuit was a yellow scream in the gloom. Her hair frizzed out wildly in all directions, reminding me momentarily of Elsa Lanchester in The Bride of Frankenstein. Her eyes blazed. 10 or 15 people stood behind her, blocking the in and outdoors. They had the look of people who had been in car accidents, or who had seen a UFO land, or who had seen a tree pull its roots up and walk. Billy cringed against Amanda and buried his face against her neck.
"Going out now, Mrs. Carmody," Ollie said.
His voice was curiously gentle.
"Stand away, please."
"You can't go out. That way is death. Don't you know that by now?"
"No one has interfered with you," I said. "All we want is the same privilege." She bent and found the bags of groceries unerringly. She must have known what we were planning all along. She pulled them out from the shelf where Ollie had placed them. One ripped open, spilling cans across the floor. She threw the other and it smashed open with the sound of breaking glass. Soda ran fizzing every which way and sprayed off the chrome facing of the next checkout lane.
"These are the sort of people who brought it on," she shouted. "People who will not bend to the will of the Almighty. Sinners in pride, haughty they are, and stiff-necked. It is from their number that the sacrifice must come. From their number, the blood of expiation."
A rising rumble of agreement spurred her on. She was in a frenzy now. Spittle flew from her lips as she screamed at the people crowding up behind her.
"It's the boy we want! Grab him! Take him! It's the boy we want!"
They surged forward, Myron LaFleur in the lead, his eyes blankly joyous. Mr. McVeigh was directly behind him, his face blank and stolid. Amanda faltered backward, holding Billy more tightly. His arms were wrapped around her neck. She looked at me, terrified. "David, what do I..."
"Get them both!"
Mrs. Carmody screamed.
"Get his whore, too!"
She was an apocalypse of yellow and dark joy. Her purse was still over her arm. She began to jump up and down.
"Get the boy, get the whore, get them both, get them all, get..."
A single sharp report rang out. Everything froze, as if we were a classroom full of unruly children and the teacher had just stepped back in and shut the door sharply. Myron LaFleur and Mr. McVeigh stopped where they were, about 10 paces away. Myron looked back uncertainly at the butcher. He didn't look back or even seem to realize that LaFleur was there. Mr. McVeigh had a look I had seen on too many other faces in the last 2 days. He had gone over. His mind had snapped. Myron backed up, staring at Ollie Weeks with widening, fearful eyes. His backing up became a run. He turned the corner of the aisle, skidded on a can, fell down, scrambled up again, and was gone. Ollie stood in the classic target shooter's position, Amanda's gun clasped in both hands. Mrs. Carmody still stood at the head of the checkout lane. Both of her liver-spotted hands were clasped over her stomach. Blood poured out between her fingers and splashed her yellow slacks. Her mouth opened and closed once, twice. She was trying to talk. At last she made it. "You will all die out there," she said, and then she pitched slowly forward. Her purse slithered off her arm, struck the floor,
and spilled its contents. A paper-wrapped tube rolled across the distance between us and struck one of my shoes. Without thinking, I bent over and picked it up. It was a half-used package of Rolaids. I threw it down again. I didn't want to touch anything that belonged to her. The congregation was backing away, spreading out, their focus broken. None of them took their eyes from the fallen figure and the dark blood spreading out from beneath her body.
"You murdered her!"
someone cried out in fear and anger. But no one pointed out that she had been planning something similar for my son. Ali was still frozen in his shooter's position, but now his mouth was trembling. I touched him gently. "Ali, let's go, and thank you."
"I killed her," he said hoarsely. "Damn if I didn't kill her."
"Yes," I said. "That's why I thanked you. Now let's go." We began to move again. With no grocery bags to carry, thanks to Mrs. Carmody, I was able to take Billy. We paused for a moment at the door, and Ali said in a low, strained voice,
"I wouldn't have shot her, David. Not if there had been any other way."
"Yeah."
"You believe it?"
"Yeah, I do."
"Then let's go."
We went out.
11. The End. Ali moved fast, the pistol in his right hand. Before Billy and I were more than out the door, he was at my scout. An insubstantial Ali, like a ghost in a television movie. He opened the driver's door, then the back door. Then something came out of the mist and cut him nearly in half. I never got a good look at it, and for that I think I'm grateful. It appeared to be red, the angry color of a cooked lobster. It had claws. It was making a low, grunting sound, not much different from the sound we had heard after Norton and his little band of flat earthers went out. Ali got off one shot, and then the thing's claws scissored forward, and Ali's body seemed to unhinge in a terrible glut of blood. Amanda's gun fell out of his hand, struck the pavement, and discharged. I caught a nightmare glimpse of huge, black, lusterless eyes, the size of giant handfuls of sea grapes, and then the thing lurched back into the mist with what remained of Ali Weeks in its grip. A long, multi-segmented scorpion's body dragged harshly on the paving. There was an instant of choices. Maybe there always is, no matter how short. Half of me wanted to run back into the market with Billy hugged to my chest. The other half was racing for the scout, throwing Billy inside, lunging after him. Then Amanda screamed. It was a high, rising sound that seemed to spiral up and up until it was nearly ultrasonic. Billy cringed against me, digging his face against my chest. One of the spiders had Hattie Turman. It was big. It had knocked her down. Her dress had pulled up over her scrawny knees as it crouched over her, its bristly, spiny legs caressing her shoulders. It began to spin its web. "Mrs. Carmody was right," I thought. "We're going to die out here. We are really going to die out here."
"Amanda!"
I yelled. No response. She was totally gone. The spider straddled what remained of Billy's babysitter, who had enjoyed jigsaw puzzles and those damned double cross-sticks that no normal person can do without going nuts. Its threads crisscrossed her body, the white strands already turning red as the acid coating sank into her. Cornell was backing slowly toward the market, his eyes as big as dinner plates behind his specs. Abruptly he turned and ran. He clawed the inn door open and ran inside. The split in my mind closed as Mrs. Repler stepped briskly forward and slapped Amanda, first forehand, then backhand. Amanda stopped screaming. I went to her, spun her around to face the scout, and screamed, "Go!" into her face. She went. Mrs. Repler brushed past me. She pushed Amanda into the scout's back seat, got in after her, and slammed the door shut. I yanked Billy loose and threw him in. As I climbed in myself, one of those spider threads drifted down and lit on my ankle. It burned the way a fishing line pulled rapidly through your closed fist will burn, and it was strong. I gave my foot a hard yank, and it broke.
I slipped in behind the wheel.
Shut it or shut the door, dear God!
Amanda screamed. I shut the door. A bare instant later, one of the spiders thumped softly against it.